Blog Talk Radio.
Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann, and I want to thank you for joining me here today. I got to tell you something funny. Right before we went on the air, or as we started broadcasting, the show started streaming, I, for some reason, lost my internet connection. So I guess this was probably a good time to have a two-minute intro song. So anyway, folks, you know, we just kind of roll with it with new technology. That's kind of how it goes. But anyway, wherever you are listening in the world, I am glad you're joining me. Please note that I'm also the founder of RightStream, the RightStream Radio Network here on Block Talk Radio. And we have two other hosts on the network at this point in time. So I want to just be sure that I put a plug in for both of them because they're doing an exceptional job with both of their shows. And the first one is Lisa Tarvez. And she is an author, metaphysician, intuitive, angelic communicator, a certified holistic healer. And she broadcasts a show called Just Believe with Lisa Tarvez, which airs on the RightStream Network on Blog Talk Radio every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. So if you just go to blogtalkradio.com/RightStream, you can listen to all of Lisa's archives. And if you want to listen to her live, just go to that same link, and you can tune in to hear her every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Her shows are awesome. She's got great guests. They talk about, you know, useful, uplifting things relating to health and wellness, spirituality, you know, developing your intuition, interpreting dreams, just a whole variety of just very interesting topics. So check out Just Believe on the RightStream Network with Lisa Tarvez every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. And then every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, military historian, journalist, and author, he's a very, very accomplished author, John D. Gresham, hosts Military Monday here on the network at 1 p.m. Eastern. And particularly if you're a history buff and someone with an avid interest in the United States military, you'll love John's show. He always brings on interesting guests as well in areas having to do with national security, terrorism, history, Cold War, specific battles such as the Battle of Midway in World War II. And they really delve deeply into a lot of these issues and kind of gives you a whole new perspective on history and gives you a whole new context about specific military events and why they were so important to our nation and to the world. So if you've never listened to Military Monday with host John D. Gresham, not to be confused with Grisham, please tune in to the Right Stream Network every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. And again, you can easily get to it by just going to blogtalkradio.com/rightstream. And then finally, there's yours truly, me, hosting Right Stream Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern every week. And I typically bring on two accomplished authors, and that is the case this week with my two guests. And I'm going to get to my first guest here in just a moment because I'm rambling on here and I see it's already 1:05. But just, again, just want to let you guys know to please tune into the archives and follow the hashtag WriteStream, WriteStream, on Twitter. All right, well, this week's first guest is an author by the name of Catherine Bone, and she is with Crimson Romance Publishers, so we're definitely going to talk about that. She is a self-described army brat, and she's going to talk to me today about her historical romances, which include the books Duke by Day, Rogue by Night, and Lost Treasure, Captive Princess. I'm also going to talk to Catherine about her insights on the ever-changing publishing industry and her thoughts on how to use social media platforms to, you know, engage your readership, you know, connect with them, and hopefully sell some books along the way. So I want to just read a little bit about Catherine, and this is in her own words from her website, CatherineBone.com, and that's K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, E as in boy, O-N-E.com. And Catherine says about herself, "I've been passionate about all things historical since I was an army brat traveling all over the world. Initially, I dreamed of being an artist, but when I met and fell in love with Prince Charming, my own dashing lieutenant vowing duty, honor, and country, I found myself saying, 'I do.'" And just as a side note, who can blame her? I would have done the same thing, Catherine. "Not long afterwards, I was whisked away to army bases, castles, battlegrounds, and cathedrals, where tales of swashbuckling characters and unforgettable adventure filled the lonely gaps when the army called Charming away. No longer nomadic, I've set down roots in the South, where the lieutenant and I raised four children and live with our fluffy Maine Coon." And before I bring Catherine on, I just want to let you all know, if you're on Twitter, you can follow her at Catherine L. Bone, and you can also like her Facebook page and follow her Pinterest boards. And I'm going to put the link to all of that into the chat room. And you could also find links to all of Catherine's sites at my blog, DariaDiGiovanni.com. But without further ado, let me welcome to Right Stream Tuesday author Catherine Bone. Hey, Catherine.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for having me here, Daria.
Well, it's great to have you here, Catherine.
I did it.
I'm sorry, I'm so like a little frazzled here. It was so funny. I mean, the show went live, and all of a sudden my internet connection decided to give out on me. So I was a little freaked there for a moment. But thanks for being here. So, Catherine, let's start off. I want to just give you an opportunity to, you know, I know I read a little bit from your bio on your website, but I want to just give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to the audience, and then we'll get into talking about your books and writing and all of that good stuff.
That sounds great. I, as I said, as Daria read in my short bio there, I was an army brat, grew up traveling all over the place, probably never lived anywhere more than 2 to 3 years, and then met my husband, and he was also in the army, and he spent about 22 and a half years in the army, and we traveled all over the place, and now I'm kind of in a stable place, finally able to put down roots, and it's been enjoyable to finally live in one house and see everything that we planted grow and watch our kids grow and have friends that they've been able to keep and make all their, you know, all through their school years, which I never had. But what was great about my upbringing was the fact that I was able to go and see and do so many different, to different places and learn different cultures and meet different people. And one of the things that I found was that people are the same everywhere you go. It doesn't matter where you are, they're all the same. They may speak a different language or they may have a different culture, but everybody's the same. And so that also helped me realize when I wanted to write historical romance, when you take that step further, everyone is the same, so therefore the people who live in the past would have the same wants and needs and desires that we have today, and the only thing that would be different would be their environment.
Right. Okay, so it sounds like really that was the inspiration behind a lot of your books. Now, Catherine, did you initially start out as a writer? I know you had a lot of dreams. You got married and kind of traveled all over. What prompted you to really seriously sit down and start writing?
Well, I've always loved to read. I think I remember starting to read my first romance, and that, of course, as everybody else probably read, would be the Kathleen Woodworth novel, The Flame and the Flower. And I remember reading that when I was in my teens. And starting as early as probably when I was about 11 or 12, I wrote poetry. And I remember I was real excited when I was a ninth grader and got my first poem or haiku put in the school yearbook. So that was very exciting for me. So early on, I realized that writing and expressing myself was something that I really liked to do. But for the most part, I really kind of pursued the art aspect and the creative aspect and being an art student. I went to art school and got married, and still along the way, reading a lot, just enjoying books. And what really struck me was being able to get outside of myself, reading historical romance, going to a different place, you know, the whole aspect of being rescued and heroine being rescued and the hero being, you know, that alpha macho goodness. And while my husband was in the Army, he was gone a lot. So there were times when he would be gone 2 to 3 weeks at a time. There were times where we lived places for maybe 3 years, but he was gone for 2 years of that time. So
wow.
During that time, reading was real important to me. It was, as I was raising four kids, it was my escape, it was my getaway, and it was also a comfort to read, you know, about romance. And so that really struck me. And then when my fourth child was about a year old, we got our first computer. And I think as everybody does when they get their first computer, they think, well, maybe I'll write a book. And, you know, it's kind of that same thing everybody feels. But during that time, I had been writing poetry the whole time. And so I finally decided, yeah, I really would like to do that, mainly because I wanted to give back. I wanted to give other people the opportunity to escape and feel comforted when they're lonely. And that was the main thing that drove me to start writing.
Wow, that's great. So, Catherine, what do you have, you know, since you brought up new technology and computers, how do you feel about that? Do you think it's been mostly a positive for writers? And tell us what your experience has been with that, and maybe the evolution of how you got to Crimson Romance, which is your publisher.
Yes, I'd love to. As far as the computers go, I think what struck me about computers from the very beginning was the ability to get research. You know, whereas before everybody had to go to a library, they had to check out books, or they had to buy books, and I had my own stash of research books at that point in time. But what I found about the Internet was the accessibility of being able to find research, say, being able to research Italy or England without having to actually go there, and actually being able, especially with Google Earth, being able to see where things are located and enjoy trying to understand where things are in respect to each other in a specific place or time period even, because then you could get maps from a different time period. So so as far as that goes, the whole Internet aspect was a big boon as far as being able to write faster because you could research faster. So I did all that. I researched. I was writing a Western, what I call my Native American, paranormal, shape-shifting, post-Civil War, Western romance. It had all the aspects in it, and I've actually
sounds
been
fascinating.
Five plots in one book, too. You know, but every first writer starts somewhere, and you know, it's all an experimentation process and a growth process. And but anyway, during that time, I learned all about researching. I learned all about using the computer and the Internet, and but also during that time, I had my four children, And so I didn't write consistently. I would write maybe for a year and a half, and then I'd stop. I did start submitting, and when I got rejections, you know, I would just, you know, say, okay, well, how can I reinvent myself? How can I do this better? Online classes were great as far as the internet goes, and joining writing groups were very important too. But so it's been a 20-year process, is what I'm trying to say. I joined RWA in 2004, and then I joined my local writing chapter in 2005. And it wasn't really until my youngest was a senior, I was a freshman in high school, that I actually started trying to really seriously pursue writing. So from the time that I started doing that to the time I found Crimson Romance was about 6 years.
Okay. Well, and you know, and you brought up an excellent point, and I want to expand on this a little bit too, because it sounds like you had a really great attitude regarding rejection letters. And I know as writers, we tend to be a sensitive bunch, at least I certainly am, and it's something I work to try and overcome. So, but you had such a great attitude, it sounds like, that you use that as a vehicle to improve and to get better. And Catherine, while I'm on that topic too, I wanted to ask you for your thoughts about writers groups and how your advice for authors in trying to find the right writers group, because it seems like based on different guests that I speak to, not all of them, you know, not all of them are created equal, and you have to be careful that you're actually getting constructive criticism. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, I think that's a very important thing to point out. Constructive criticism is very important. As I started out going through my writer's group and learning different people, I had different critique partners, and then you go to different workshops and things like that. You do get a lot of criticism, and I think what was very hard for me, and I think what kept me from really being more consistent and trying to really seriously pursue writing for the longest time, was that fear of putting my work out there, that fear that someone may reject my work, that fear that someone may not like it. So that was very strong for me, and so I really had to learn how to overcome that fear, and I think the best way that I was able to do that was to actually surround myself with people who thought like I did. You know, a lot of people out there think you must need a padded cell because you hear voices in your head or something like that, you know, when writers start talking about the voices and the characters who start talking to you. Thank goodness I don't need a padded room because they actually are characters from novels. But when it comes to finding a writer's group, I would say it's very important to find a writer's group that's near you, and also find the main group. Like, for instance, I found Romance Writers of America, which is our main romance writing hub, very supportive, really pushes for the rights of authors, and gives back to romance writers everywhere. It's very important to find a main group, say, like that, and then within that group, you can find the other groups and where they're located in comparison to where you live. And once you find that group to join, and not just join, you know, to come and listen and everything, but to really kind of try to get your foot in there, make friends, get to know people as best you can, volunteer. It's very important to volunteer. I'm really big on that. And that helps kind of get you situated where you're actually more comfortable to be around people, and therefore you can find out where the best place is for you as far as where you can find constructive criticism. Constructive criticism is very important because as writers we have very fragile egos, I think, probably like actors too. And so one of those things that's kind of hard, it's really hard to judge. It's kind of a hit or miss kind of thing, and you have to kind of go through different experiences to find the right critique person or critique partner. I've had quite a few different experiences, and some of them have been really hard. At first, I cried a lot when I got results, and then after a while, and I know this is cliche, but they call it, you know, where you have to develop a thick skin. You do get that. It's hard won, but it does come, and when it does, sometimes you can just sit and laugh at some of the comments that are made. But it takes a while to get there.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No, that's great. And it sounds like, you know, in your case, because you're a romance writer, you found a group, Romance Writers of America, that's specific to your genre, which I think probably is also very helpful. And that maybe is something that people need to look out for as well, you know, to try to find a group that specializes in what they're writing.
Yeah, I think that's key. I think whether it's a mystery group, fantasy group, I think sci-fi, I think that you need to find your niche and you need to kind of find a way to get into that. And the wonderful thing about the internet is you can find those places.
Well, that's the thing. And just like you were saying about the research, Catherine, I mean, that's such a great point. I mean, it's all at our fingertips now, and it's such a time saver. So, you know, you apply the same toward finding a writer's group. I mean, meetup.com or whatever, you know, there's different avenues of finding, you know, finding things without even having to leave your home. And then, I mean, I've had many guests suggest, you know, go to a couple different ones until you find one that where you really feel comfortable. And then, you know, do it. And I've had other authors who say, you know what, I don't do writers groups at all, you know. So it just, I guess it depends on the individuals. But Catherine, tell us about your first book now. I want to get into talking about your books because I know you've got several. And so tell us what the process was like with your first novel and maybe how you came to meet, you know, Crimson Romance and how the publishing process went.
Okay. My first book is, published book, is Duke by Day, Rogue by Night. It's the first book in what I call my Nelson's Tea series, and that goes back to research. I was doing some research on Admiral Nelson and the Napoleonic Wars. My first book was set in 1804, and I found this really, really wonderful little nugget, which will happen when you do research. Sometimes it'll just set off your imagination like crazy. But I found out that Admiral Nelson never went without his tea. Even when he was on board ship, even during battle, and he would take his tea. And so I took that a step further, and I thought, well, what if Nelson's tea was code for mercenaries that he had under his wing, and he could have them, you know, expedite them to do whatever he needed if he just requested his tea. And so that's where the Nelson's Tea series idea came from. And these are men who are first sons of every walk of life, every tier of life, and they're not suspected because first sons, typically, especially in among the Tun, were not allowed to serve in the military. So because they had to, you know, be there to accept a dukedom or whatever. So and they were less suspected to be mercenaries. So I thought that was also a very cool aspect too. So Duke by Day, Rogue by Night is my first book with Crimson Romance. They were great, and they have been great. I've had wonderful covers. I've been really pleased with everything. And so the first book is about a man who's first in line to be a duke, and he's struggling to find his sister's killer. And in order to do this, in order to be a member of Nelson's Tea, he has to have two personas. And the mercenary persona that he takes on is Thomas Sexton, a pirate. And he infiltrates this pirate crew, this crew of this pirate ship, to look for the benefactor of these pirates who is responsible for his sister's death. And by day, and that's where the Rogue by Night comes in, by day he's a duke's son, first son. And so he plays the dandy. My book is like Master and Commander meets a Scarlet Pimpernel. So by day, he plays the dandy so that people won't suspect that he's capable of doing these other things. And so that's really where the idea for that came from. There's also another character in the book, when the book starts out, Lieutenant Henry Guffaw. And he's also part of Nelson's Tea, as well as a couple of other guys. There's really about 20 of the men that are a part of this group. It's a very small group. And so my first series is about the first three men. And so what happens is Percival Avery, who is the duke, and, you know, the actual man who plays the dandy, that is his real name, he is masquerading as Thomas Sexton, and he infiltrates this crew, and he's been on the ship for a while. But anyway, they attack a merchantman, and as, you know, pirates will do, they'll attack. And so the book starts out with that attack, and, of course, my heroine is on that ship. She's on her way to get some relief from her aunt, a long-lost aunt in Spain, who can help fund or give her some money to help her father pay for his debt, because there's some other things going on where some blackmail and things and betrayals that are going on where her father, it looks like he's going to lose his reputation. He is a duke as well. Her father is a duke. So, of course, back then, you know, losing your reputation and everything was terrible. And so she's trying to go get the funds to help save his reputation. But she doesn't get very far because the ship is attacked. And so then starts the whole process of our heroine and hero meet. And what happens after that? Percy is forced to mutiny on that ship and expose his men to the enemy in order to save her life, because she just also happens to be the niece of his commander, Simon Danbury. So I really had fun writing that story. It came out really fast, and it was just a joy to write. And the sequel to that book, The Rogue's Prize, is a book. It's actually Captain Henry Gaffald's book, because Lieutenant Gaffald is promoted, and he is now in charge of his own ship. And so the second book, The Rogue's Prize, comes out this next Monday, and I'm real excited about that one, because Henry is hates pirates because of what happened in the first book, Duke by Day, Rogue by Night, and he's out to get every pirate he can find. Unfortunately for him, he's attacked by a ship that has a female pirate captain, and the rollicking fun begins from there. So it's my favorite book so far, I think, because it's just rollicking good fun, and Henry has to redeem himself from the first book. So he has an ultimatum. He has to save one of the members of Nelson's team who's now captured in Spain. He has to save him in order to redeem his military career, but he's waylaid by this female pirate, and that puts a kink in his plans. So it's a good time.
It sounds fascinating. It sounds like a really interesting read, Catherine. Now, so the process for the first book you said was fun. So I take it, let me ask you a little bit about that. Like, do you have times that you set aside to write? I mean, not just with the first book, but maybe do you have habits that you as a writer kind of stick to keep yourself on track? Like, talk to us a little bit about that.
Of my writing process? I like to do storyboards.
Storyboards? Okay.
I like to do storyboards. I have a storyboard for each book. Because I guess that's because of my art background and I'm a visual person. I just like to see that, and I'll kind of plot out the chapters and use post-it notes and stick those in the little chapter slots. And I have the images of my characters, so that really helps a lot because I'm a visual person. But that's about all I do. I'm kind of a combination. I'm not really all plotter, and I'm not really all panster. I do a little bit of plotting, and then I like to go along and kind of sometimes make things up as I go. But also that brings back in the research, because then you'll find something, and that'll trigger. So, oh, yeah. And I found a lot of little tidbits while I was writing the second book. So the third book, The Rogue Surrender, is the one I'm writing right now, and that is about the man that's captured in Spain. And so it's going to be really interesting. The research I found is just really fascinating, and I'm going to be able to include that. So I'm real excited and jazzed about that. As far as my process goes, like how I write during the day, I have a part-time job. So I work 8 to 1, and then I come home and I have lunch. And I'll probably write from 3 to 7. And if I'm having a really good day, I'll probably come back in and after dinner and write some more. I try to write every day if I can. Lately, it's been kind of crazy because my family, we've had all these different things, graduations, college graduations, and kids moving to Alaska and things like that. So we've had a lot of things going on at our house, so things have been a little, my schedule's been disrupted. But But typically that's what I'll do. I'll go to work, come home, eat lunch, and then write.
Well, congratulations on all the good family news, by the way.
Awesome. Thank you.
So, yeah, so that's great. So, you know, it's funny. It's just different for everybody. And I always like to ask, you know, just because it's people are interested in that, I think. And for me, I have to say that I don't really have, you know, it's just, it just depends on every given day. Although, you know, I do try to blog every day and kind of stay disciplined about things. But, Catherine, which reminds me, I also, you know, since we were on the topic of technology and new media, well, a couple of things. One, I just want to say I absolutely love your cover art on your books. They're beautiful. Did you design them? Now, I know you mentioned Crimson Romance. I think you kind of said that they were responsible for that. But was that a collaborative effort? You know, how does that work, too, with the book covers and the artwork and everything?
That's a really good question. Crimson Romance will send me an art cover sheet, and I'll fill out information like what my characters look like, what my characters, maybe little some things about the character, some keywords that might describe the character, what scene I would actually like to be depicted on the front of the book. I typically wanted a different kind of cover, and I'm so pleased they've given me something different, which, you know, typically you'll see on a Regency novel, you know, the Duke and the Lady. And I just fascinated at from an art perspective of faces and just the motion of the body. And so I was just really pleased that they came up with my pirate. You know, he's holding his blunderbuss pistol, and he's got that stubble, and he just looks so handsome. And then with the second book that's coming out, The Rogue's Prize, my heroine, my pirate heroine, and she's masked at the beginning. And so I thought that was really cool that they did that. So what I will do is I'll send in the art cover sheet, and then the wonderful guys at the art department in Crimson Romance take off, and they do the rest, and they've been fabulous. I've just been floored by everything they do for me. I have one other book, Lost Treasure, Captive Princess. That's actually a contemporary. It was the first contemporary romance I wrote. And it's about an Italian prince who's lost his family, has had a scandal that has taken 20 years and for him to uncover the whereabouts of his mother's stolen necklace. Unfortunately for him, he's almost 30, and every prince, every Italian prince in their family has to present that necklace, which is an engagement necklace, it's the emerald necklace, has to present that necklace to a fiancé by their 30th year or they forfeit the throne. And so that necklace has been gone for 20 years. He's been searching for it for 20 years, and he was actually witness to the event that where the necklace was stolen. He witnessed it. And so he's made it his lifelong purpose to find this necklace. Well, lo and behold, an American jeweler from Atlanta has just made a copy of that necklace, and she's put it on the market. And, of course, he's got to get it off the market so that he can make sure none of his people know that necklace is missing, because it hasn't been seen for 20 years. His people think that it's been held back for the fiancé. And so he buys this necklace, and he has this woman bring it to his home in Monte Blanco, Italy, a tiny island, a principality. And at that point, he's trying to find out where the original necklace is, because he wants the original necklace back. And so that's where the lost treasure, Captive Princess, comes in.
Very cool. Man, that sounds like a great one, too.
Yeah, I loved writing that book because I lived in Italy for 3 years, and so that book was just a fabulous write for me because I was able to write from what I actually had experienced in Italy, so I was real excited about that book.
Yeah, and Catherine, I'm sorry, when did that come out? Go ahead.
March 4th this year.
Oh, wow, okay. You know, and since we're on that topic, let everybody know where they can purchase your books.
Duke by Day, Rogue by Night is available at Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. iTunes. You can get just about anywhere as an ebook, and it's also available in paperback at this time. Lost Treasure Captive Princess is available at all these places as well, but only as an ebook right now. And the Rogue's Prize, which comes out Monday, will only be available in ebook. But it, I think right now it's only showing up on Amazon. And the way things have been going, it'll probably show up on Barnes & Noble in about a month or within a few weeks. But I think it's also showing up on iTunes right now, too. But again, with Crimson Romance, our books come out on ebook first, and then within 3 to 4 months, they come out in print on demand. So I'm expecting Lost Treasure Captive Princess to come out on print on demand anytime soon at this point.
That's fantastic. Yeah, you know, I find it's funny because some people are really, really into the Kindle and the Nook, and they love, like, you know, the new technology as far as being able to download a book into a device and carry, you know, and have as many books as they want basically on that. And then I encounter other people who are just like, I'm old-fashioned. I like to hold a book in my hands. I'm kind of torn. I mean, I think it's great that there's all these formats, I guess, but for me personally as a reader, I really like to hold a book too. So it's great that all, you know, your books are available in all of them. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's true for all of us. I think many of us are tactile people, so we just like the feel of the paper in our hand and being able to actually physically turn the page. And there's just that sound of a page turning, you know, that's so pleasing too.
So that's so true. Plus, you know, I don't know, I don't do this. It depends on the book, but a lot of times I'll highlight something, and maybe this goes back to, you know, AP English in high school, and, you know, it was a demanding class, and, you know, I was just taught to highlight important things and write notes, and so it's just having that ability if you want to be able to write in the book too. But on the other hand, I do understand and see the benefits for authors and readers. To having something like a Kindle, because my gosh, you can pretty much carry one little device around and read, you know, and it's almost unlimited in terms of what you can read on there, what you can download. So I can see that side of it too. And I just think as authors, it's great to be able to take advantage of that.
Yeah, that's really true. And I have to say, I just got a brand new phone. It's a Samsung S4. And I'm so excited about this phone because I can also read my Kindle on the phone and my Nook. And all my books are on there. All the books that I have purchased and everything, I can read both. So I'm like, what? This is amazing.
Yeah,
it is. About how technology has changed. It's just crazy.
It's really cool. Now, is Crimson Romance, is that a new style publisher? I take it. It sounds like they are. Speaking of new technology and new publishers.
Yeah, Crimson, that's a good question. Crimson Romance started releasing books last year. I believe June 4th was the first week that they started releasing books. They released 5 books a week, one from every genre per week. They're an offshoot of F&W Media, which is Adams Media. Adams Media does a lot of the Chicken Soup for the Soul books and a lot of educational books and things like that. They've always done nonfiction, but this is their first foray, as it were, into the fiction world. And so Crimson Romance, we just celebrated our first anniversary, and we're real excited. We've got a wonderful year ahead of us, and I'm just really lucky to be a part of Crimson Romance and grateful that they like my books so much they wanted to publish them.
Well, that's awesome. And so how did you initially come across Crimson Romance? Was it on Twitter?
It was by word of mouth. My good friend and brainstorming partner, M.V. Freeman, she released Incandescent. She had submitted to them, and so she told me, oh, you should check Crimson Romance out, and I did and submitted and was really surprised that it's so funny. I was just really surprised that the two of us, you know, were going to be published by the same publisher. So we were real excited about that. But I did hear first from her, and I think she had heard from someone else on the internet.
Fantastic. And I interviewed MV about a month ago on here. I think, and actually, Catherine, I think you're the third author from Crimson Romance that I've interviewed.
Well, that's cool. That's really cool. Well, getting getting our word out there.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and I found out about you guys on Twitter and through Lydia Aswolf. I've met a lot of great writers, and I think that's how I came across MV. And it's just, you know, it really is amazing how there's a snowball effect online, and it's been really cool to see how Twitter has such a huge writers community. I mean, I've met so many phenomenal authors on there and writers. It's been great. So I know you're on Twitter. So since we're on that topic, let everybody know how they, you know, what your Twitter handle is and Facebook and all that good stuff, where we can find you on social media.
Oh, that would be great. On Twitter, I really love Twitter. And I have to say real quick that I was listening to a publicist speak, and she thought Facebook, her thing was, she thought Facebook was the greatest the best venue among the two, Twitter and Facebook, for authors. And I really find that Twitter is just, there's just something about Twitter, I think, that's more interactive and more social and more fun than Facebook. And so I just love Twitter. And my handle is at Katherine L. Bone, KATHERINEL. BONE, and I'd love you to check it out. I try to be very active on there. I love it, interacting with everybody and making new friends. I really enjoy Twitter more than anything. And I'm on Facebook. Katherine Bone is my Facebook handle, and I also have an official fan page. So look for this Katherine Bone's official fan page. And I'm also I'm on Google Plus, and I have a blog on WordPress, my blog, and I'm trying to be more consistent about blogging. My blog is katherinebone.wordpress.com, and I have a website, www.katherinebone.com. And my website hasn't been updated in a little while. I do apologize for that, but that's because it is the brainchild and design of my wonderful youngest child, who just graduated from Auburn with a graphic design degree, and she created that for me. But this semester was her senior project, and she's been so busy, but she's going to update it for me, and I'm going to link my blog to that as well. So lots of plans in store as far as getting things set up with social media, but I try to have a strong presence.
Yeah, and, you know, Katherine, I agree with you on Twitter. I sort of had this – I went through this transition because way back, I guess in 2008, when I joined Facebook and Twitter, I really liked Facebook better. And then once I figured out Hootsuite, somebody told me about Hootsuite, and that third-party dashboard application, it made Twitter make so much more sense. And so now I love Twitter, and I do have a Facebook page like you, but I'm not – I don't know. I feel like Twitter, like you said, it's a lot more fun. It's a lot more interactive. There's so many great writers on Twitter, and you can just follow the different hashtags. And, you know, I started the WriteStream hashtag, and there's MWriting hashtag, and so many of them. And you can just – I don't know. I just find it to be a lot more useful. So I guess I kind of disagree with that publicist. I think that I think it's important to be on both, but I definitely favor Twitter. But I want to just commend you because I love – and commend your daughter because your website is absolutely beautiful. And I love your blog, too. So tell us a little bit about how you feel about blogging and how important it is for writers. And you know, what are some of the things you blog about aside from your books and writing?
Well, you're asking me great questions. You really do, Darren. I appreciate it. As far as thank you first for the compliments on my blog and the compliments on my website. I'll be sure to tell my daughter. Maybe that'll get her a little fire under her, and she'll want to update it for me a little faster. but anyway, as far as blogging goes, I've blogged at quite a few different places, and this is my first very own blog. And again, I've tried to blog as often as I can. I think blogging is important. I think as far as readers go, that's my big thing, is that I'm here for readers. I want to write stories for readers. And I think as far as a blog goes, as far as a Facebook page goes, as far as being on Twitter goes, it's a way to reach out to readers. And especially with a blog, because with a blog you have a larger format and you can write a little bit more. So But I think that readers also want to know what's going on in your life. So I tend to try to write, you know, some of that as well. As far as blogging goes, before I was published, I tried to, you know, I would write a little bit more inspirational kind of things for writers. And now, and I'll do that occasionally, but now it's trying to reach out to readers, trying to let readers know what's going on with me. Not that I'm egotistical, but I just do realize that that's probably what readers want to know. And then you have to, you know, how much do you tell and how little do you tell? And so I really try to do that. But the funny thing about it is that sometimes, you know, you just get frustrated because it's like cricket, cricket, cricket. You know, you write something and you hear crickets. You don't know if anybody's really reading it. You don't know because maybe you don't get any comments. And so you don't know how effective that is. And so I think it's kind of hard sometimes, and it can be discouraging from a blogging perspective if you feel like, you know, nobody's listening. Or, you know, some, or you doubt yourself and you say, why am I doing this? But again, it's for the readers. And so whatever you do as a writer, I'm sure you know this, it's for the readers that we reach out like we do.
Yeah, and I found, Catherine, and I want to ask you if you did too, that a lot of times, and you did mention it, readers are more as interested in you, the author, as they are in your books. Did you find that to be the case?
I do. I think so. I think they, as far as, you know, where do you get your ideas? You know, what inspires you? What experiences have you had in your life that have led you here? And that's why I get such a kick out of doing this whole pirate thing, sailing off to adventure, you know, the new horizon, all that. It really fits in with what I would say anyway. And so I really feel like, you know, it's just all kind of culminated in this one explosive, excitable thing that I can use to my benefit because, I guess it just fits is the word I could use. But I just get real, real excited. I try to be really positive. I'm all about being positive. There's too many things in the world that can get you down. And the one thing I try to tell everybody, especially writers is that who are not published yet, you've got to believe to receive, not achieve to believe. Because so many of us think that we have to write a book and get those first three chapters just right, send them to a contest, and then we get the comments back and they're bad and they hurt our feelings or you know, we're gutted. And you know, we're upset. We think that we have to final on a contest in order to be a writer, or that we have to be published in order to be a writer. My point is not achieve to believe. I want everybody to know that you've got to believe to receive, because as long as you believe in what you're doing, as long as you have faith in what you're doing, as long as you love what you're doing, you're going to receive. Does that make sense?
Amen. Yeah, I'm sitting here applauding silently because I don't want to. I don't want the noise to. Well, I'll clap. I agree with that.
Oh.
Give you some applause. Absolutely.
But that's what I try to get across in my blog.
No, that's excellent. I mean, it's certainly something that can carry over into all aspects of life too. You know, not just writing. I mean, I completely agree with you. And you know, and that's where how you build relationships too is. It's not all just about, you know, buy my book, but, you know, go to my website. You know, it's about really engaging people at that level, you know, just that, you know, you said at the beginning, you know, kind of people are kind of all the same no matter where you go. And it's just connecting at that human level with people that I think brings them, keeps them coming back. And I found with blogging that just because people aren't necessarily commenting, if you have, you know, a stat press or something in your blog where you can actually see your traffic, you can see where people are reading you, but they may not necessarily be commenting for whatever reason. So, you know, just a thought I wanted to put out there that, you know, you're still having a positive effect on people. You may not necessarily know that through their commenting, but, you know, people are definitely reading.
Well, I appreciate you for saying that because actually MV told me to check my stats, and I keep forgetting to do that, but that's something I need to remember to do. I haven't done that yet, so... That might be a little bit more helpful as far as knowing, you know, are you actually, you know, reaching people? Are you actually doing any good, you know?
Yeah, and then again, that's where a lot of the social media comes in as well, you know, to share things on Twitter and interact and talk. And I've just found, I mean, I've been blogging since, I don't know, 2005, and people were really into commenting for many years, and it just, I don't know, it just seems like people don't comment as much anymore generally. So I don't know, but again, like MV's right, it doesn't mean that people aren't reading. So, and that's why I do recommend that bloggers have something in their dashboard where you can see actual statistics of how much traffic and where they're coming from and what your most popular posts are, because then you can kind of tailor what you're going to write about to that too. If you find that people are interested in, you know, these three topics mostly or these three areas, then you can kind of, you know, feed that interest more.
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing. I'll have to be more aware of that. But that's as far as my books go, that's the one thing that I want everyone to take away from my book, that there's always hope. There's always hope. No matter if you're being attacked by pirates, you know, and this guy looks pretty scary, the whole situation's scary, or if you're shackled on a ship, you know, as in as my female pirate is on in the Rogue's Prize, the beginning of the Rogue's Prize, or if you're, you know, held captive in Spain or whatever. I've got another series I'm doing that I'm real excited about. It's like a 7-book series I hope to get published. About 7 men who go off to war and what happens when they come back, and they've had to deal with some terrible things. And but again, the hope aspect, you know, that's the one thing I want people to take away from me and from my books and from my blog, from anything that I put out there, is that there's always hope. Never give up. I love Winston Churchill's thing. I have a bracelet I wear on my hand all the time, my wrist. Never, 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 never give up. That's Winston Churchill. And
yep.
It's the most amazing quote that you could ever remember. That's one thing you could ever remember. That's the one thing that'll get you by day to day.
Oh, yeah, I love Winston Churchill. Yes, that's an awesome quote. And it's great advice, and it's true. You know, can't let things – you got to stay positive, and you have to just be persistent and just never give up, ever. So,
yep.
Now, Catherine, what are some – we have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to ask you, you've been a world traveler. What are some of your favorite places in the world, most inspiring?
Okay, cool. Italy was just the best place to live. My husband and I, our two oldest, were there for 3 years, and we loved it. We would just love to go back. You know, Under the Tuscan Sun and all that with Diane Lane. It was exactly like that. It was just amazing. The people there, so courteous and loving. The weather's fabulous. I really loved it there. I've lived in Germany 3 different times, and I've lived in Japan. And I think as far as here in the United States, I love the Midwest. We lived in Kansas. It was great. Even now, if I close my eyes, I can see the wheat blowing in the wind, you know, and feel the breeze. It's just it was just a wonderful place. We lived over there near Kansas City in Leavenworth. It was just an amazing place. And I've been to... when I was in Germany, went to so many different castles, fabulous castles. Aschaffenburg Castle was amazing. It got hit during World War II, but you know, they fixed it up. It didn't get. I think it was gutted. I can't remember, but it's just amazing. Linderhof Castle, the Neuschwanstein Castle, the one that Walt Disney modeled his castle after. I've been there like 3 times. It is just breathtaking, fabulous. Those are some of my favorite places ever. La Maddalena is a little island in Sardinia, just breathtakingly beautiful. I've been able to go down to Cancun in Mexico. It's extremely beautiful as well. So there's just been so many wonderful places. And then one summer we took a trip, just a road trip kind of thing as a family, and we went up the East Coast, and I just could not believe how beautiful the coastline is, how different it is from the California coastline, the eastern coastline. They're in Massachusetts and Maine. Maine was just fabulous. I just loved Maine. Of course, my husband said it was too cold, so there was no reason that we, no way we were going to live there. But I would love to live there. It's just amazing. It's just like every place you go to, if you find the beauty in it, and I think you'd be happy. You know, it's just, we just have to take a moment to look around and appreciate what we have around us. The world is an amazing place, basically.
Well, those are words to live by, Catherine, for sure. Can you hear me?
Have you got a favorite place? Have you got a favorite place that you've ever been?
Do I have a favorite place? Well, I love, there's a lot of different places in Florida that I absolutely love. I have to say, I'm definitely a warm weather girl. So,
I like my husband, likes the warm weather.
I love Marco Island. I love Naples, Florida. I love pretty much any place in Florida. You mentioned Disney. Oh my gosh, I've been there so many times. Love Disney. But, you know, I've been all through the South. I love that. I mean, I grew up in Pennsylvania. I can't really say. I've been to Canada. I've been to Montreal and Quebec. Those were beautiful. I haven't been the world traveler that you've been, but I really would love to go visit, you know, more of the American West someday. It just looks so beautiful. And I've been to Seattle several times, and that's a pretty city. That was when I was working for a company that was based out there. So, but I agree with you. I mean, you definitely, wherever you are, even if you don't necessarily like the weather or the climate or, you know, the terrain, you could still find the beauty in everything. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to live there, but I do agree with you that every place has something unique to offer, no matter where it is. And, you know, our job is to notice that.
Right. Yeah. I am actually a Texan at heart. I was bred there and born there, and I love Texas.
I've been there.
It seems like whenever we drive back towards the Southwest, it just, I can breathe easier. It just, you know, you've got the big skies. There's just something about every different place you go where you can just take in something for your soul. You know what I mean? So it's
absolutely.
Just it's amazing. But I do, I'm like you. I like the Southwest. We've been there. We've gone to Little Bighorn, Yellowstone. When I was writing my first book, the Native American book, Fort Laramie, Wyoming. What a cool place, just sitting there and sitting where, you know, all these historical things that you researched are happening, and just kind of feel it around you. I think one of the most poignant places I've ever been was standing on the memorial over the Arizona in Pearl Harbor. Boy, that was just,
wow.
You could almost just sense everything. It's just amazing. The most, it's the best memorial I think America owns. It's just fabulous.
Well, I hope to get there someday. You know, and I get the same feeling, Catherine, from Gettysburg. I don't know if you've ever been there, but just being in that town, and gosh, that would be a great setting for a future book for you if you're interested in that time period. But I mean, being there sort of evokes that same kind of feeling that you're talking about. It's, I was almost overcome with sadness when I'm there, because it's just so, I don't know, you just get such a feeling being there.
That's funny that you mentioned Gettysburg, but that is the one place I am looking so much forward to going to. I read The Killer Angels, saw the movie Gettysburg. I just love it. And they got Gettysburg down when they did it from the book The Killer's Angels, and everything just about, I just love Colonel Buford. He got the high ground. I mean, I just love Gettysburg so much. I've been to Shiloh. I've been to Chickamauga. I've been to quite a few others, but Gettysburg is the one that I do want to go to. But I do agree with you. When I was at Shiloh, there's just something about, you can just sense there's just that presence, you know,
of
all the sadness and the death and the loss and
suffering,
the victory, even, you know, from the other side of it. So it's just amazing.
Yep.
But Gettysburg is one of the places I do want to go.
Well, hopefully, you have to let me know when you get there. But anyway, I cannot believe, Catherine, you know, this interview went by so fast. I just had such a great time, and I want to thank you for joining me today. And certainly hope you'll come back in the near future. And I want to let everybody know also that we're going to reschedule. Catherine was going to be my guest on the RightStream Twitter chat this week, but because I have jury duty, I'm going to have to reschedule that, so we will keep you posted. Catherine, anything else you'd like to add before we sign off?
I would just like to say thank you so much for hosting me today and allowing me to be on your show. It's been great talking to you, and I hope that everybody out there remembers that there's always hope. And of course, you know that my next book, The Rogue's Flag, is coming out next Monday. But just take with you every day that you can get through whatever you are facing. It's just going to take time. And always have hope and never, 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 never give up.
Well, and that is the perfect place to end it. So, Catherine, thank you so much, and I will definitely be seeing you on Twitter.
All right. Thank you so much, Daria. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye,
take care. Bye.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. That was the wonderful Catherine Bone. Please follow her on Twitter at Catherine L. Bone for all the latest updates. You can purchase her books on Amazon.com. And visit her website for more information as well, CatherineBone.com. I'm going to take a short break here, and we will be coming back at 5 minutes after the hour with my next guest, author Kia Heavey, who I'm very excited to speak to. So stay tuned, and we'll be back after these brief commercial breaks.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the RightStream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES for details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
I'll never get used to these 10-mile runs. They are taking so much time out of my day.
Are you training for a marathon or something?
Diabetes runs in my family, and I heard if you lose lots of weight, you can prevent it. So I started running like crazy, and I cut my calories big time.
Oh, get real. You don't have to knock yourself out to prevent diabetes. My doctor said it's the small lifestyle changes you make that matter because it's easier to stick to them.
Wow, really?
It worked for me. 6 months ago, I started walking a lot and I stopped eating the fried stuff. I've lost 10 pounds. My doctor said I'm doing great.
I'll have to ask my doctor about this. I'd love to get my life back.
Talk to your healthcare provider. Losing a small amount of weight by being active 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and eating healthier can prevent type 2 diabetes. To get your free game plan for preventing type 2 diabetes, call 1-800-438-5383. This is a message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the National Diabetes Education Program.
The National Osteoporosis Foundation predicts that by 2025, osteoporosis will be responsible for approximately 3 million fractures and $25.3 billion in cost each year. Osteoporosis and low bone mass are estimated to be a major public health threat for almost 44 million U.S. women and men 50 and older. I'm Marjorie McGinn, President and Executive Director of Women in Government, an organization of state policymakers. You're never too old or too young to improve the health of your bones. You could have osteoporosis now or be at risk for it without realizing it. Often, breaking a bone is the first clue that you have osteoporosis. Talk with your healthcare provider about osteoporosis today. With daily exercise and calcium consumption, you can lower your risk for this disease. To learn more, visit womeningovernment.org. That's womeningovernment.org.
Funding provided by Novartis Pharmaceuticals.
Hi, this is Daria Ann, author and founder of the RightStream Radio Network. If you're an author, writer, blogger, or just someone who enjoys reading and learning, I hope you'll tune in to our inspiring, insightful, and educational programs. Every Sunday, join author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis for Just Believe at 1 p.m. Eastern, when she explores a variety of spiritual topics, including alternative healing modalities. A gifted intuitive from a young age, Lisa's book, entitled Just Believe, chronicles her journey from a childhood of seeing and communicating with angels to a career in which she uses her talents to help others emotionally, spiritually, and physically. Each week, she interviews experts in the fields of personal growth, spiritual development, and alternative medicine. Military Mondays with author and military historian John D. Gresham analyzes current events and issues from the perspective of the United States military. Tune in at 1 p.m. Eastern every Monday when John, author of such books as Uncommon Valor and journalist for the Defense Media Network, interviews accomplished guests on important topics like national security and defense and global terrorism. RightStream Tuesdays with Daria Ann airs at 1 p.m. Eastern and welcomes authors in diverse genres, including romance, drama, military history, spirituality, and politics. We also speak social, discussing the benefits and pitfalls of social media platforms and the numerous and plentiful publishing formats now available with various experts in order to help other authors navigate through new technology to reach higher levels of success. During every broadcast, we welcome your calls at 347-945-7246. And of course, the chat room is always open. Can't listen live? No worries. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/rightstream to listen to the archives. And be sure to join us for our weekly Thursday RightStream Twitter chat at 11 a.m. Eastern using the hashtag RightStream on Twitter. Rejoice in the flow of creativity with the RightStream Radio Network and the RightStream Twitter chat.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. This is your host, Daria Ann. You're listening to RightStream Tuesday on Blog Talk Radio. I'm just waiting for my second guest to call in. She was on the switchboard and kind of dropped off, so hopefully it's not a BTR issue. But in the meantime, let me just tell you a little bit about her. Her name is Kia Heavey, and she is a self-described creepy story writer. She's going to be joining me in the second hour here to discuss her book, Night Machines, and her forthcoming book, Underlake, which is due out in early 2014. And this is from Kia's bio in her own words. She says, "I live in Connecticut with my husband, our hometown police chief, and our two children. After graduating from Barnard College with a degree in German literature, I went to work as an art director in advertising. I wrote Night Machines because it was a book I really wanted to read, but no one had written yet. I love a captivating, creepy story that weaves a spell. Nemesis by, Rosamond Smith is a favorite. I also love Andrew Klavan, I do too, side note, and some of Dean Koontz's work. Please feel free to send me recommendations of good books to read. I'm working on the next book, Underlake. Like Night Machines, it will be cross-genre fiction, a sort of mystery, romance, suspense, spiritual fantasy. But unlike Night Machines, Underlake is being written for a YA audience, as well as their moms who read half their books already. With fair winds, it should be available in early 2014. So that's Kia in her own words. And let me see here if she's back on the line. I believe she is. So without further ado, I welcome author Kia Heavey to RightStream Tuesday. Hi, Kia.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, great. How are you?
I'm good. Sorry about the confusion. I think I called the wrong number before.
Oh, that's okay. It's great to have you on the air.
Thanks for having me. It's very exciting.
So, listen, I just read a little intro of you, Kia, but why don't you go ahead, I'll just, like I do with everyone, give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to the audience, and then we'll start talking about books and your writing and all that good stuff.
Sure. Well, that intro that you read was pretty much the rough outline. And as far as writing, it's something I've always done on and off since I was a child. I had a very good example in my mother, who was always a writer. Ironically, you'll never find any of her books published, but she never didn't write. So it was just kind of a normal state of being. So it was more of a hobby almost in our house. It was something you just did when you had downtime. You know, back when I was a kid, we didn't have the internet or anything like that. So we had to make our own fun.
Yeah, well, same here.
Yeah, well, I don't know. You look a little younger to me, but anyway. And what else? So And also, I'm a very creative person. That's how I make my living. My day job is that I am an art director and graphic designer. So actually, I have more of a visual background. But I never stop creating, even in my spare time. It's usually a hobby of one sort or another. So I was usually, she had liked music too, so I was always in bands, and we would always write our own stuff. We were never cover bands, you know. I would sew clothes that I wanted if I couldn't find something that I liked. So, you know, it was only natural for fiction too. Excuse me, that if I couldn't find a good book that I liked, eventually I was at a place in my life where it worked for me to start writing it, so I did.
Wow, so you are a woman of many talents, Kia.
Well,
now, do you...
many attempts, anyway.
do you design, since you're a designer, do you design your book covers?
I do, yeah.
Because they're very compelling.
Oh, thank you. I hope so, yeah. And actually, the first version of my book that I put out was print. I heard you talking to the last guest too, about choices, whether people like paperbacks or ebooks. I always like a paperback, and I just assumed that most people did. And also because I'm a visual person professionally, it was pretty easy to put together the paperback layout. So, and then somebody explained to me that you do need an ebook as well, so I had to figure out how to do that too.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You know, and I hear you on that, because I'm definitely old. Like, when it comes to books like that, I'm old-fashioned. I like to hold them in my hand, but as authors... Mm-hmm. And marketers, we have to understand that we need to cater to our audience as well. So
exactly.
For those people who really love their Kindle.
Yeah, and I do have a Kindle, and I understand, too. The instant gratification is great. And also, you know, when you read a lot, if you want buy every book you want to read, you can wind up having nowhere left to live. So the Kindle
exactly.
makes some sense.
Exactly. I've got lots of books in my storage unit. So, yeah, I know
oh,
how
I'm
that
sure.
goes. So, Kia, well, let's talk about Night Machines. So let's kind of take a step back and tell us about that process and, you know, how you started writing it and when it was published and you know, all of that good stuff.
Sure. I work as a creative professional, and that was a period of time when my job was not creatively rewarding anymore. It was just a lot of busy work mostly, but other people were making the creative decisions. So I was looking for a creative outlet. At this time, I had young children, and so... the things that I used to do, play music and so forth, weren't really an option anymore on top of having the kids and working. And there came a period of time where my husband was working a lot of nights. He's a policeman. And my kids would go to sleep at about 8 o'clock, so I had about an hour every night to myself. So I had a computer, and I said, well, that's one thing I can do now. So I started doing that then. And I think that when you have that hour a day planned, you can really move a project along. And I started writing the book because I'm an avid reader. I love to read. I personally like romantic thrillers. And, you know, the problem with a lot of romances, though, is that they get married and the romance ends. And in real life, that's really the beginning of the whole adventure. So I was trying to find books that were good romances for married women with children. What happens then? And it was very hard to do. And I began reading a lot of contemporary women's fiction, and I was very disappointed in it. I could not relate to the protagonist, because apparently the only kind of romance you can have after you're married would be if you go and cheat on your husband, and it was kind of a letdown for me. I'm not into that. And you know, so I had a difficult time identifying with these protagonists. So that was at the point where I said, well, I guess I'll have to write a book. And while I'm at it, I want it to be good and creepy, because I like that, and to be a little bit of a psychological thriller. And it was fun. It's great to write your own book, because you can add all the elements that you really like to see in a book. And so I really got into this book, and I found it to be a wonderful mental exercise, too, to have such a large story in your head and to have this arc in your head and to have to keep it organized. And I know different people work differently. I did try to write an outline first, but I don't know. I found it limiting. I knew what the story was going to do, but it just took about a year to write it. So that was it. Once it really got going, it really pulls you, and you really can't stand not having time to write, and every now and then your life interferes, like maybe someone would get sick or you'd have to go on a trip or whatever, and you couldn't write for a couple days or a couple weeks, and it would drive me crazy, you know. So it really felt good to finish the first draft, and that was when the work began, of course, but anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, now you made the decision to become independently published, correct?
Oh, I spent about a year trying to get an agent.
Okay.
I worked in the fashion industry for 20 years, so I really understand that trends drive industries, and publishing is very much like that, too. And I think this was around when Twilight was huge and things like that. And I knew a lot of women my age were reading these YA books, and I thought it would be a, it's something interesting for them because it's more written for women 30 and older who are married and have kids, but it has sort of a little bit of a paranormal twist to it also. But it's kind of a weird cross-genre book, and it's very difficult to sell that. You know, publishers and agents are looking for something specific already, and if you don't have it, they can't really figure out how to market your book. So after about a year, I took a class. There's a literary agent who lives in my part of the country here, and she was teaching a class called So You Wrote a Book, Now What? So I took this class, and even though she was a traditional agent who worked with traditional publishers, she kept talking about self-publishing. She's like, I think this is great. It's the neatest thing. You can do it yourself. It's the wave of the future. And so after hearing her talk about it so much, I began to explore it more. And I have to agree with her. I think it's wonderful. It's so freeing. You can do whatever you want. Yeah. So I wound up doing that eventually. And I still, you know, had the dream alive for a while of getting an agent and a publisher. I don't know. I kind of gave up on that after a while because, you know, you learn more about it as you go along, too. I understand that once you're traditionally published, you sometimes have to give them your copyright or they will edit your book for you. You lose a lot of creative control of the process. Hello?
Yeah, that is absolutely true, Kia. Can you hear me?
Yeah, that was weird. Yeah. Yeah,
I know. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if Mercury's in retrograde or what, but it's like I've been having some communication problems today.
Gremlins.
Just gonna roll with it. Yeah. But no, you're absolutely right, and I believed, and it's interesting to hear you tell that story that a traditional literary agent was touting self-publishing as the wave of the future. I mean, that's good to hear because I personally believe from what I've seen, and I've met so many talented independent authors over the years, and I try to now use the word independent instead of saying self-published. But I think, you know, the stigma – no, I mean, I'm just for myself, but I do think at the same time –
yeah.
I think the stigma has gone away, and there's so many talented authors out there, and I know we want to kind of touch on this as well because of just our viewpoints and our philosophies that, you know, also I think aside from everything you just mentioned about being driven by trends, I do think there's a bias in the publishing industry as well where just as you were talking about, like, you know, if you have traditional values and you think that marriage can be interesting even after the kids and it doesn't have to involve having an affair, well, maybe that's not what they want because they don't want stories about people who are happily married and, you know,
correct.
Having
different... It's boring, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, what does that say about our culture that's boring? I mean, you know,
well,
we should be celebrating that sort of thing.
You don't want me to get started about what this says about our culture, really. I have kids, and... I think the culture has always kind of worried me, but the direction it goes in now. In fact, I don't really have a blog. I just have a website, and every now and then I'll post a thought on it as if it were a blog. And I just the other day wrote a thought about hearing about Paris Jackson's suicide attempt. I thought it was the saddest thing. But it just made me think that, you know, it's, whenever you see a fresh young person in Hollywood, you always think, oh, I wonder how long it'll be till they OD or wind up in the booby hatch or something. And it's sad as hell. And it's just like such a messed up place, and yet it is the chief driver of our culture in this country. And how do we tolerate this? Why do we tolerate this? It's really messed up, and really messed up stuff comes out of it. So, again, once you have kids, the stakes are even higher. And actually, the book I'm working on now, Underlake, is a book I wish I'd had when I was a teenager because a lot of the teenage things are not very, I don't know, positive. I don't know what the right word is, but... not as ethical as you'd like. Yeah, so, yeah,
so
I agree with you.
So tell us about Underlake. So you have kids, so maybe that helped. Did that help make it easier to be able to write for that type of an audience?
Oh, yes, and one of my first feedback readers is going to be my teenage daughter, so she can tell me if it sounds idiotic or not. And I also worked hard trying to keep it somewhat time neutral because, you know, technologies change every 5 minutes. And
oh, I know.
Yeah, and the social media tools the kids use change every 5 minutes. At first, everyone wanted Facebook, and then everyone had to be on Twitter, and now everybody needs an Instagram or this or that, or now it's the Vine. And I'm not going to have anything specific like that in my book. I've read other books for YA audience where the author makes this big conscientious effort to be very hip and with it and say exactly what social media the kids are using, and I'm trying not to do that because it'll look old in about 6 months, you know, before I even get it published, really. So... aside from that, as far as attitudes go, well, I liked what your last guest, Catherine Bone, was saying, that people are the same, and kids are the same, too, and a lot of the struggles I see my own kids having now are things that I struggled with too. So I'm trying to keep those overarching timeless themes to, at the front of the story, and everything else I'm trying to keep in the background and not make a big deal. So.
Right. Do you think, though, Kia, like, the struggles are the same, but do you think that maybe social media, as much as I love it, do you think it's mm-hmm. also exacerbated those problems for kids? Because just by making everything so accessible and things can go viral so quickly, so
oh,
that
yeah.
all the things you're dealing with, you know, that we dealt with maybe when we were young, they were bad enough. And but now these kids are not only going through those kind of things, but it's being broadcast.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
and it's there forever. Your mistake is broadcast, and your mistake is there forever. So, yeah, we teach our kids since, you know, before they could read, don't post any personal stuff. And I don't even post an awful lot of personal stuff. I'm not a big Facebook user. I don't know if it's paranoia even, but I try to keep things to myself more as far as the Internet goes. So, yeah, and the other thing that I think that the social media does is I find kids not really spending a lot of time with each other. Physically, they just sit in their houses and communicate with each other and send each other links to funny things. And it's kind of sad. I mean, it's like I yell at them, go out with your friends, have a friend over, you know, and they don't
yeah.
so much.
Yeah,
go learn your social skills.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? I could say the same for adults, though. I can't really charge just kids with
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's passive entertainment. And I don't know. It's, they should get out and socialize more. So.
No, I agree. You know, one of the things, and again, I love new media. I mean, obviously, I'm someone
well,
who
I love it too.
But at the same time, I feel like we've kind of lost. Like, for example, and I want to get your opinion on this. Like, the art of letter writing, I think, is just kind of fallen by the wayside because everybody
yeah.
sends emails now.
We send the occasional thank you note. That's about it. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've even found, oh, my gosh, and I even hate to admit this, I used to pride myself on my handwriting, but I don't write that much. Literally, I mean, I write in my journal maybe every day, but not really that much, and I feel like my handwriting has been
yeah.
a casualty in all this new media stuff.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. I think you're right. I don't know if it's good or bad. You know, they've just stopped teaching cursive in the elementary schools around here. I think they're dropping that, so people just
why,
don't read it
though?
Anymore.
I know, but that's, to me, I think that's very sad.
I think that's sad, too. You aren't going to be able to read historical documents anymore. You should be able
yeah.
to read that kind of handwriting. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but, Kia, getting back to now the publishing process. So you wrote your first book, and how did you go about, you decided to self-publish, but how did you go about the process of finding the right, you know, the right publisher for you, like the right self-publishing company?
Yeah, a little bit of research. I also figured that I had written this book for an audience of women who were similar to myself, so I figured that their reading habits would be similar to mine, and I was a big customer of Amazon.com, and then I did some research listening to other self-indie authors and radio shows about publishing, and several people mentioned CreateSpace, which is a division of Amazon, so I researched that a little more, and that is the route that I took. As I said, I'm a big fan of Amazon. I think that they are majorly responsible for the independent publishing craze and that they've enabled it. They've used the technology. They back up authors. I love what they do. I love their entrepreneurial spirit. It's very American. Any one of you can write a book and publish it. Why not? Who's stopping you? You know, and we'll sell it for you. And I love that. So,
me too.
Yeah, it's so cool. So I went with them. And, and then once I did the e-book, I went through the Kindle store too. I can obviously save it to other formats, and I could sell it other places, but as I mentioned, I have a full-time job and kids, so I don't have a lot of free time to put it on a lot of other platforms right now, so I'm pretty happy with Amazon.
That's fantastic. So you would recommend for anybody listening that's thinking about taking the self-publishing route that you would recommend CreateSpace and
yep.
Amazon to them?
Absolutely, and then it's Kindle Direct Publishing or Kindle Direct Publisher, something
mm-hmm.
like that. KDP is the e-book division. So it's all through Amazon.
Now, Kia, just getting back to, you know, what you had mentioned before, you know, I finished the book and then the work began. Let's talk about the editing process. Did you, you know, what are your thoughts about that? Did you have someone else edit the book for you? Obviously, you probably did it yourself, but
every independent author should please, please get professional help editing your book. As a reader, I love independent publishing because that's where all the fresh ideas are now, and you can read things you would never see traditionally published. There's an unlimited choice now in reading material, but so much of it is poorly edited that it's kind of a letdown. Even if it's a great story, it, you know, pulls you out of the narrative every time there's a grammatical error. So, yes, you should have it. You should get some help with the editing. In my case, my first book, when I finished it, you have a first book too, I know, and perhaps you had the same experience when you're finished with that first draft. You're like, well, my book's done. This is great. I can't wait to get it out there. But you shouldn't.
Yeah.
And I showed it to some people. A friend of mine had written a book himself, and he hooked me up with a really wonderful editor, and she offers all sorts of editing services. Her name is Joyce Schaefer, and she was so good for me in so many ways. I sent her my book for something called a comprehensive critique, and so she read the whole book, and she gave me a couple pages of grammatical tips, and then she went through the entire Word document and highlighted problem areas so that I could fix them. And she also gave me some overarching comments about the entire manuscript. And the other thing that she did, of course, was to be so encouraging, and I'll never forget her for that. She just was so positive about, wow, this is a brilliant story, this is great. And, you know, the first time you show your first book to someone is terrifying, because what if it's horrible? And she was just so positive that she gave me so much confidence to pursue the project. So, and as I say, also her editing tips were useful. Like, actually priceless. So I went through that draft. I incorporated her advice and editing tips. I learned to write better every time I did a new draft. So once you have a fairly well comprehensively critiqued, edited draft, then you start showing it to feedback readers, or that's what I did. And I tried to target, again, target audience readers rather than just, I think I gave one or two to random feedback readers who I did not meet personally that somebody arranged for me, and I don't think that all of them would have picked this book up on their own, so they didn't all like it. One person, for instance, was a science fiction aficionado, and this is not that kind of sci-fi, so they didn't care for the book, so their comments weren't very useful to me. So I started targeting my feedback readers. I got a few more, and then once I had all their comments, and this is also very important, you don't need to take every comment from your feedback readers. It's your book, and you should make the final decisions. And so I incorporated all the feedback, got some great ideas from people, and then I did another revision. And then, again, that woman that I told you about, the agent who taught the course about publishing your book, she also had made a great recommendation, which is take a day off from work, print out your entire book, and sit and read it out loud to yourself. And that's a crucial thing to do, and everyone should always do that, because when you read the sentences out loud, you can hear how they flow or don't flow, and you find a lot of stuff. So I did that. And then when I was almost ready to publish, I had my mom do an edit for me, because that's what she does professionally. So I didn't let her see it until then, because it's your mom, you know, and that's, anything they say can really change what you do. Yeah. But I happen to know that she's an excellent editor, so I couldn't really waste that resource. So she was good enough to do a proofread and line edit for me at the end. And then you get over your jitters and you put it up there and you publish it.
Fantastic. So how long did that whole process take?
Oh, I was kind of discovering it as I went. I'm going to say another year,
okay,
more or less. But so the whole thing start to finish was probably 2 or 3 years.
Okay. And I have to tell you, Key, I'm so happy to hear you mention about talking out loud, because I'm currently ghostwriting a book for somebody, and I read out loud all the time. Because
no, you're right to do it, yeah.
It's that process about you hear the words, and it's – I'm very auditory. I'm more auditory than visual. And
right.
So, but I think for all writers anyway, you should read out loud, because you can't really – after you read something so many times over and over again just to yourself, it just – I can speak for myself. I just start to lose the ability to discern whether or not it's really good, or whether it flows, like you said, or whether it has that perfect cadence. And I find reading out loud is so helpful.
Oh, yeah. So, and then that's a really important trick, and I don't think a lot of people are aware of it. So if anyone's listening, do it.
don't worry that you sound crazy. I mean, I do it all the time, and it helps me tremendously. And it also helps – you know, too, like even just picking up on typos and just, little things, you know, you literally just can't see it after you, because you as the writer know what you intended to say. So you just literally lose the ability to see mistakes. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
But.
Oh, Underlake is really about to get sent out of here to feedback readers, because I'm almost to the point where I can't see it anymore. Yeah. So yeah. It's time to hear what someone else thinks, and I'm very nervous about that. Again, it's the same thing. You finish working on something after a year, and you put your heart into it, and what if it really stinks? You know? We'll see how it goes.
But, you know,
but
and
that's
I'm
what
glad...
feedback for. Huh?
Absolutely. And, Kia, you know, you made a great point when you were talking about your editor, and, you know, feel free if she's accepting clients to put her name out here again. But I just, it sounds like it was such great constructive feedback.
And in
your case, she was recommended to you. I mean, and I know, I think you and I talked about this offline, but, you know, we were talking about, like, some writers are really into writers groups.
Yeah.
Others are not. I think I fall into your camp. I'm not into the group thing. I don't know why. What things should you look for, I guess, in finding the right person, I guess, to critique your work? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, while you're writing it, you're thinking about your target audience. And so while you're writing it, you keep your eyes open around you. And I find them either through people I know personally who fit the demographic I'm writing for, and I also find them through friends on Goodreads. So I look at other people's reviews of similar books, and I see what they say, and I try to get a feel for their taste in literature. And if I think it's a good fit, I can contact them. Most of them I already have a Goodreads relationship with. And ask them if they'd be interested. And I'm probably going to do about 5 or 6 feedback readers. So, and I'm trying to, as I say, this book has 2 intended audiences. The primary audience is girls about 15 years old, high school girls, and the secondary audience is their moms, women in their 40s who also enjoy YA.
So now was this, I'm thinking it might have been, but was the process much different with your second book because the audience is different?
Not the writing part, no, not really.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's funny, I mean, I think, you know, while writing this, I think about what it is that I personally like about reading YA, and I don't read a lot of it, but some of it I think is great. I really enjoyed at least the first book of the Hunger Games trilogy, and I find that I can really relate to the protagonist, even though she's a teenage girl who, you know, doesn't have a job and kids and a husband and stuff. And I think that for perhaps women my age, it's kind of a really nice escape, and it helps us be back in touch with the girl we were once before we added all of these other people to our lives. And so it's kind of fun that way. So I was thinking about that while I was writing it, too. And it made me think of, yeah, and then you think about yourself at that age, you know, and what would you have been looking for in a story or a book. So we'll see how very out of touch I've grown, or maybe I'm not.
So you're looking at an early 2014 release?
Yes. I'm going to do it then so that when I get the ISBN and copyright date and everything, it'll be 2014, because from a marketing point of view, that way I'll have a whole year to be like a new book. You know, I could probably get it done at the end of this year, but it'll already be a year old then.
God, that's such a good point. Okay.
Yeah, so there's something else to think about.
Which brings up another good topic, because, you know, I think that after you write a book and it's edited and it's ready to go, I think your work is just beginning because, you know, in spite of what that movie says, I don't believe if you build it, they will come. I think you have to build it
and then
people come. So what are the kinds of things that you do to generate interest in your books?
This is where the dream of having a big publishing company behind you comes in, because they have all of the advertising dollars and the connections and the bookstore contracts, and they would get your book out there for you and advertise and make your book a name that people have heard. For me personally, I am not as good at it as they are. As far as marketing goes, for my last book, I experimented with several different things. I did Google Ads. I did other ads. One thing I like to do is I would go to a blog, a fairly popular blog that people read that would also perhaps like my book, and I'll buy an ad on their blog. And I recommend always getting a graphic ad, not just a line of copy or two. So if you can put an ad together with a strong visual, that's a good idea. So I would run that for a week or as much as I could afford. You should budget a little money for advertising. I recommend internet advertising. As you know, the internet has really given people the opportunity to pursue their own interests, so you get some very specific audiences at each website or blog. So in some ways, it's really helpful, yeah, because you can really target an audience. And so it's a good way to do it. I found that whenever I ran an ad on a blog, I would probably sell a few books, a handful of books, And every book you sell, you also have to remember, helps to get the word out. If the person likes it, they'll post a review on Amazon, they'll tell their friends. So you hope that it snowballs. what else did I do? Oh, and the other thing that's super important is right when you're launching your book especially, you should have a nice big long list of book review blogs, and you should be soliciting them to review your book. So that was a huge thing to do too. And once you do that too, and then they review your book, then you can pull excerpts from their review and use them to help sell your book. So it's kind of like a vicious circle, but a good vicious circle. You know, so the more reviews you get, the more reviews you can use to sell your book, and that'll help you sell more and get more reviews. So that's another good option. Yeah.
And I actually have to say, I just got a review copy yesterday for an author, and I'm going to, you know, read it and post a review on my blog. I love to write book reviews.
Oh, great. Good to know.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love
to
do that for
you. I'll have to
send you some books. definitely. And, you know, she's got her latest book in her trilogy is coming out in July, so which reminds me, I got to really get to work on reading that and writing that. But you know, it's great. The book reviews, I think, really go a long way toward helping. Now, Kia, have you ever gotten into book trailers, or is that something you plan to incorporate in the future?
That's something I've tried to do, but I personally don't have the technological skill to put it together, and I have tried to badger my brother into doing one with me, but you know. He's a grown man with his own life, and it's hard for everybody to find time. I think they're a neat idea. I don't know how many people will go and look at a book trailer. I personally don't really look at book trailers if I'm looking to buy a book. But I guess so I'm not the person to ask how's that. I don't know.
Now, do you ever do any more, getting away from new technology for a minute, but do you ever do any old-fashioned kind of marketing, like maybe talk to different book clubs or groups?
Here's where it's tricky for me. I am not good at self-promotion, and I cringe with embarrassment and humiliation when I have to speak in front of people, so I don't put myself out there as well as I should. I was very lucky to meet another woman who actually lives in my town. I met her at a writer's conference a ways from here. Her name is Sharon McMunn, and she has an excellent book out, too, called Finding Out, by the way. And she and I, we call each other our writing partners, so we're like a little writing club unto ourselves in some ways, and we meet regularly for lunch, and we get each other all jazzed and excited about our project. And wait, what was the question again?
I was talking about maybe, you know, non-technology-related promotion, yeah.
Correct. She is a genius at this stuff, and I've gone to some of her events, and she, her profession is sales, so she is so very comfortable speaking in front of people and selling a product of any kind and telling a story. She's just so poised and good at it, so it's a pleasure to watch her. And she does that. She talks in front of book groups. She also organizes author events. For instance, there's a local author event that's coming up, so she's going to get together with a bunch of other authors in this area, and they're going to have book signing, wine tasting, whatever it is, and there are enough names at it that it's going to be interesting, and I'll bet a lot of people will go to it. You know, so she does that kind of thing. She addressed a local women's business club. What is it called? I think it's called BIG. I forget what it stands for, but it's actually a national organization with chapters everywhere, and it's a women's entrepreneurial social club sort of thing, and they have lunches once a month, and so my friend spoke at one of their luncheons, and she talked to them about her publishing story and the process, and she did an amazing job. She's very good at it. So, yes, it's a wonderful tool if you can do it, because that really gets a buzz out there about your book. If you meet someone personally and you talk to them when they get your book, then they're more apt to say, oh, I know that author. I met her. This is a great book. So she does a good job. And if I follow her on the internet, I see that she has more book reviews. She has more Twitter followers. She's just doing a really good job marketing. So if you have that skill, use it.
So now, you are on Twitter, though, so I know, you know we're getting back to social media. Are you anywhere on any other platforms that you use?
No, I have Twitter. I have a website, which is kiahevey.com. I'm on Twitter at kiahevey.com, and it's spelled K-I-A-H-E-A-V-E-Y. So very creative names for my social media handles there. that's pretty much it. Goodreads. I go on Goodreads a lot, and I follow other people, and they follow me. And that's really, you know, where readers congregate looking for stuff to read and suggestions. So I recommend that a lot, too, for networking. And then I have several online groups that I belong to of writers, of like-minded writers, who look for fiction especially that, again, is informed by more moral world point of view. My friend Sharon McMunn, she calls it grown-up fiction, which I think is a good way of putting it, too, where the people just act like grown-ups in it.
Yeah, what a concept, huh?
Yeah, grown-up fiction. So I have another good friend online who is actually a guest of yours. Her name is Jamie Wilson, and she runs the conservativefiction.com website, which is another way of looking at it, people with traditional morals or value sets. So you can go to conservativefiction.com, and she has an author page there. So, again, you can find a lot of people who are interested in this concept of fiction that promotes things that we believe in. You earlier mentioned a bias in the publishing industry, and that is true. It is there, and it's rather progressive, and, you know, we don't all enjoy reading about that. We don't all enjoy picking up a book and being told we're stupid or we're bigoted or whatever. You know, it's not how I spend my leisure time if I can help it. So there are some good online communities for people who appreciate this kind of grown-up fiction.
And that's phenomenal because, you know, I think, you know, we talked about the culture a little bit earlier.
Right, yeah.
And the only way to get control of the message and to engage the culture and try to turn it around is to entertain people. You know, we all know there's tons of nonfiction out there for people who believe like we do. But unfortunately, if you're trying to get out of the choir loft, those people are not going to read, unfortunately, like Liberty and Tyranny. You know, I mean, we would read that. So I think it's so important to have talented writers who have, you know, traditional values and believe
Correct.
In the Constitution out there writing fiction that's going to entertain people and get a message across in an enjoyable way.
Well, there is a classic hole in the market right now. There is a huge gaping hole in the market, and there are many authors who are working to fill it. And because they have been shut out of traditional publishing for so long that most of them are independently published, and that is another reason why I love to read independent publishing, because these voices are there and they tell these great stories, and they're stories that I actually want to hear and that other people would probably enjoy too, but they don't even know they exist because they are not the you know, the mainstream institutionalized entertainment option right now. So, you know, it's time for a little bit of a cultural revolution and an intellectual revolution, and it's happening, and it's happening in independent publishing, and that is where all the fresh ideas are, and it's great.
Yeah, it truly is, and I have to give a shout-out because Jamie is now in the chat room. Hi, Jamie. I just said hello to her in there.
I am not trying to chat and talk at the same time. Sorry.
Yeah, believe me, I have trouble managing the switchboard and talking at the same time.
Yeah, me impressed that you can do all of this at once.
I'm so happy that I was able to connect with all of you online and for Jamie starting this group because it's so needed in our culture. And the funny thing is, and I say this about Hollywood too, I mean, we see so many examples of movies that are wildly successful, you know, that do celebrate traditional values, you know, on those rare occasions when Hollywood produces them. So I think it's such a fallacy that people say, oh, well, it's all about the money. No, if it was really all about the money, they'd be producing more of this wholesome content that people want, you know?
No, it's about design by committee. It's about safety, you know, safe choices. When a company is going to invest millions of dollars, no one person is ever allowed to decide that, and it has to go through all these committees, and it gets dumbed down, and my brother calls it big mediocre. It's very hard to find anything of exceptional quality because it that's what the big corporate model does to it. It's not flexible. It's sclerotic. It's intellectual hackery at this point. It's formulaic, and that's why we're getting all these rehashes in Hollywood. They're afraid to try anything new. Again, just like indie films were always the way to go if you wanted to see something new, same with indie publishing. If you want a fresh idea, that's where you got to go. You're not going to find it from the institutionalized sources.
No, and it's a shame. You know, it's just, I don't know, it's just a shame that it's like that. But again, that's the benefit of new media, because you can bypass all those gatekeepers.
Yeah, but the bad part is there are two or three problems. One is it's uneven. Some people do not go through the feedback and editing process that they ought to.
Right.
And the other problem is that there are millions of new voices out there, and it's really supremely difficult to zero in on the good ones. Everyone's out there. No one has a big enough budget or anything to put themselves on top. So it's hard to find each other. Again, I'm going to shout out to Jamie Wilson for pulling together a lot of people and we're starting to make our quality more consistent and our message more consistent so that there'll be a larger voice so it's easier for people to find. She is centralizing a lot of this at conservativefiction.com. And another person I'd love to say thank you to is Robert Bertrand, who was also a guest with you, I believe.
Yes,
and,
he was.
Yeah, and he is just doing yeoman's work right now, getting the word out, using social media, and really trying to lift some authors up there and get their name known and to do what he can to give us some entertainment options. So I'm really happy to have met these people online. I'm happy to have met you online. I met you through them. You know?
That's so right. Thought, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's funny, Kia, you were reading my mind because I was just about to mention Robert, and I'm not sure if it was during my interview with him or somebody else. It might have been when I was talking to Jamie. I don't remember, but I made the point that I really wish that these big, you know, GOP donors, you know, their money would be so much better spent if they would put it behind people who are actually trying to change the messaging.
Oh, yeah. Well, Andrew Breitbart, you know, he always said that politics is downstream from culture. I'm not even worried about the politics part of it. I'm worried about the culture part of it. It's, you know, a yucky place to live your life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, tell me.
It's demoralizing. So I would like to have a nicer intellectual environment.
Right, but speaking to your point about, you know, we have limited budgets, you know, we're using social media and all that's great, but it would really be nice if some of these people that do have the wherewithal and they do have the money, if they would wake up to the fact that culture is politics and they should start supporting people who are trying to affect a change in the culture. And not just anybody, but talented people, like you said.
You know, you just came up with a very good idea. I have a friend.
Who,
yeah, you just did. You just gave me a great idea. I have a friend who called into, I don't even want to mention it, but it's one of the conservative radio show hosts, and this woman has some unpublished books, and she wound up talking to the host of the radio show or the producer who offered to hook her up with some publishers and so forth, and it occurred to me, you know, this was all done behind the scenes, but if this radio talk show host would mention this on the air, well, he's got millions of viewers. You remember the Oprah effect, all the publishers called it. That was the gold standard if you were traditionally published, was to get on the Oprah Winfrey show.
Right.
And if you were going to be on the Oprah show, the publisher knew to do an extra run of like 50,000 books because they were going to sell that many. Well, now that you mention it, you're talking about people putting money behind it, but some people already have a huge voice. Perhaps they should do a cultural corner on their shows, like you know, read of the week, something like that. If they would, that's a really good idea. Wow.
Well, that part was your idea though, Kia. And that
it was you. You just
awesome.
Said that. Like some of these people who are already big, you're right.
Yeah,
they could focus attention. Well, that's very clever. Yeah.
It's, you know, it's true because they're constantly. And look, I'm not, and they do a huge service to our country.
Oh, please,
I'm not degrading them. But I'm just saying, you know, you turn on, it doesn't even matter who you listen to almost. They're hammering the same point, and I'm not saying that's not important. It is. But
it
somebody
is, but
could really differentiate themselves by taking this cultural tactic. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And, in fact, I used to love National Review magazine because it has that whole section at the end, what is it, books, arts, and manners. And it was, I found some great books to read in that section. That's where I discovered Andrew Clavin. I would never have known who he was. They would call attention to you know, authors that we could appreciate or films or what have you. So, yeah. All right. Well, you and or I should perhaps start writing to some of these people. I don't know how you get their attention, but have them consider adding a cultural segment to their show. And you're right. They would differentiate themselves. They could pull an entertainment element into their show, which I think could only benefit their listeners, you know, or viewers.
Right.
Because as you say, they do hammer the same point over and over. It's not entertaining after a while.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you know, we have to retake. It's not, you're not going to win elections unless you retake the culture. I mean, that's just the bottom line.
Sure.
And
we're
at a deficit because, and I'm not blaming, you know, I wrote a blog post on my blog a couple of months ago, and somebody gave me feedback. They're like, well, you know, I didn't feed the culture to anybody. I was busy raising a family. And I said, you know, I'm not putting people down. I understand that.
No,
I'm just simply saying that while good, decent, upstanding citizens were being productive and going to church and raising kids and what have you, our culture, the rug was being pulled out from underneath of us. So we have to, you know, certainly the last 100 years, but certainly the last 40 years, more specifically, 40, 45 years. And I'm just saying we got to get back in the game. I mean, I'm not blaming anyone. I'm just simply pointing out that now that we're aware of this, we have to do something about it. And
Yeah, we have to. But the thing partly, I think, is people like us who are more traditional-minded and are worried about our jobs and our families, we tend to think of entertainment, music or writing or movies, we tend to think of that as a hobby. It's not something that you're going to make your living at. Like I told you, I was in bands in college. We played, you know, rock music and stuff, but it was never something I was going to try to make a living at. That was for creative kicks, you know. But,
yeah,
we don't take it seriously. And I remember every now and then an article will come up, you know, somebody will say, oh, all of the only good artists are very liberal. That's just the way it is. Conservatives aren't good artists. It's like, oh, my God, of course they are, but they're busy. So maybe
right.
we need to, I don't know, it kind of goes against our nature because we're very responsible people and we don't want to live on handouts. We want to support ourselves, you know. Well, so we're going to have a job that we know we can make a living at, and you can't necessarily make a living at any kind of art. Believe me, I am not making a living from these one or two books I'm writing. You know, it's a labor of love. It's a creative outlet. So, yeah, it's. I think that's one of our problems is that we don't think of it as a serious profession.
Right. Yeah. But it's so needed. And, you know, like in my case, I also have the marketing and the editing and the, you know, it's, you know, you kind of, I'm ghostwriting a book for somebody, so I can kind of
right.
do other things while I'm trying to promote. And I'm so, I mean, I just can't tell you how happy I am to have met you and Jamie and Robert and this whole group.
So good to know you guys. Yeah. it's encouraging, you know, we're all out there.
Yeah. And
there's more
and
every day. Yeah. We're
right.
finding each other. and I'm afraid that sometimes it's not so much that we will be able to change the culture or that perhaps, you know, the publishing industry is going to say, oh, you guys are right. You know, we're going to publish your books too. And that's never going to happen. But what we can do is create an alternative market and just go right around
right.
it. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, like, you know, yeah, you're never going to win whatever the prize is that they give to the best writer of the year. Screw it. We're going to have our own prize then. You know, we don't want your prize. Whatever. I mean, that's silly
right.
too. That's childish and it's a shame. But, you know, we're only going to... we're not ever going to be what they want us to be. So.
No, but you're absolutely right. So therefore, we create our own. I mean, I don't think that's childish at all. I think that's a creative solution to a problem.
Well, yeah, and then that's again going back to Amazon. That's why they are so great. In fact, if you read the dedication in the front cover of my first book, they're one of the things and people that I thank. It's Amazon for opening up the gates to the great unwashed masses and letting us
yep.
Have our say. Yeah, thank you. We wouldn't be here without that innovation. So I
absolutely.
Love it.
Yeah, and I interviewed, you know, speaking of people that putting the money behind it, I mean, I interviewed Freedom Forge Press last week, too.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, and you were talking about the importance of professional editing, and I'm so impressed with them because if they accept a manuscript, I mean, then they do all the editing. I mean, they work with
the
author.
There's
and
a couple
just,
small presses that are doing that now. God bless them because that is heavy lifting. Yeah.
Yeah, what I think is awesome, and I may be submitting because the book that I'm ghostwriting now is all freedom themed. It's futuristic,
right.
but you know.
I heard you talking about it last week. Yeah, it sounded pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're gonna see, but yeah, so I guess it's gratifying to see so many people out there coming up with creative solutions and really getting
yeah.
in the game and making the effort and.
Yeah.
Maybe, who knows, maybe if enough of us are out there, it will attract somebody that's got the money to put behind the effort, you know,
yeah.
and really make it work.
I think so, yeah. Well, and you know, just you create the market. We're going to create the buzz. There's more and more of a buzz all the time. We're starting to use, like, hashtags like Confic or things like that to draw attention to a new kind of thought and entertainment. And you get a buzz going, and then people are going to say, well, what is that? Well, I'd like to read that, you know.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to do with WriteStream is try to, and that's all good. I'm not, you know, I support that. I'm just with WriteStream. What I'm trying to do is again, sort of, kind of lure people in and then get the message across so that they're not.
Yeah, you have to. No, because you're absolutely right. Because there are certain buzzwords. Like the way I think of it is, if you're using a word to describe something and it's the kind of word that the IRS would audit you for using, then you shouldn't be using it to describe your book because you're going to turn off a lot of people right away. You know, there's certain words like conservative or Tea Party or whatever that some people are going to go, oh, I'm not reading that.
Yeah,
but they don't know
sad.
That they would like. Yeah, because they've been told for years that, oh, that's going to be, you know, bigoted and stupid and backwards and whatever, and they don't even know what it is. So you're absolutely right. And that isn't even what it is. You know, it's I don't know. It's
right, but it's perception. But it is their perception because they've been brainwashed by pop
sure.
culture and public education and academia
absolutely.
And and all of these things that, unfortunately, even the word the United States Constitution has become
toxic,
which is really sad. It makes me really sad. But on the other hand, we have to be smart. Yeah, isn't it? I mean, you know, the greatest political act in the history of, you know, I'll tell you a really funny story, really, because we have a couple minutes left. But, I mean, about 4 or 5 years, I guess it was 4 years ago, I went to 4th of July. I'm walking down Flagler in West Palm Beach. They have like a big 4th of July thing every year. And I had just come from a Tea Party rally. And then we decided we would walk among the rest of the crowd. And this guy looks at me and he goes, oh, these Tea Partiers, they even have to politicize the 4th of July. And I looked at him and I said, you do realize that this is the commemoration of Independence Day, it commemorates the single greatest political act in the history of the world. So it is a political holiday. And the guy just looked at me. I mean, and this was a grown man. I mean, in his 50s. And I'm thinking, well, what do you think it is? It's not about hot dogs and fireworks. I mean, those things are great, but
it's a day off work. That's what it is.
it's like
Memorial Day. It's just a day off work.
But it's all been by design, and that gets back to us having to really get in there and work the whole culture angle. And I hope we succeed, and it's going to be an uphill battle, but I certainly think it's worth the effort.
Oh, yeah, and it's going to take a generation or two. You know, they didn't do it overnight. And I do believe it was a concerted effort on some people's part as well. So I think that's why people made sure to get leadership of certain key parts of our national culture, like our education and entertainment and news media. So
it was diabolical, but it was brilliant. I got to give them credit. I mean, they were very patient. It was over decades.
Yes, that's the thing. They're so patient. Yeah, they'll do one thing a generation. It's so patient. It's creepy.
So, but anyway, Kia, in the last couple of minutes, anything else you want to let the audience know? Anything coming up, or let them know where to find you again and where to buy your books?
I'm kind of lying low right now because I'm really focusing hard on this Underlake project. So, as I say, that'll be at the end of the year, and before it is released, I'm going to try to get some advanced copies out to get some reviews out there and so forth. Gee, I don't have much to announce at the moment. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, everyone follow Kia, though, at Kia Heavey.
I don't tweet that often. I'll tweet, like, 10 times in one day, and then I won't tweet for a week or so. I don't really blog either. As I say, if I have a thought about this or that, I'll put it on my website, kiaheavey.com, and I'll put it under News and Reviews. So every now and then I'll do an update on my project or a thought I might have on something that has happened in the news, or if I've read an excellent book, I'll mention that, or seen a good movie that other people like me would appreciate, people like you, you know. But again, I'm not posting daily either. I'm really focusing on this project, and besides that, the kids and everything. So I will probably do more at the beginning of the year. Yeah.
Sounds good. Well, I definitely want to bring you back when the second book is out.
Oh, I appreciate it.
You promote that, and I'd love to write a review of it if you
would
like.
Oh, well, I'll be sure you get a copy, and I should also get you a copy of the first one now that I think about it. I will email you after this. And
awesome.
Again, okay.
And
I already got
a
copy of your book, so I just have to read it. It's on my Kindle. Water Signs, right?
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, it looks great. Yeah. So, all right.
Well, thank you for your time today, Kia. And whenever you're back on Twitter, I guess I'll see you there. And
yep.
And we'll be talking to you again soon.
Oh, Daria, thank you so much. And you too, like Jamie and like Robert Bertrand, you're just doing so much, and I really appreciate it. Thank you for your time and your excellent job hosting this show.
Thanks. All right, you take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
You too. Sounds good. Bye-bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Kia Heavey. Please check out her website at kiaheavey.com. I want to thank everyone for listening to Right Stream Tuesday this week. I will be back here again next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern, assuming I don't have jury duty, because that is on my agenda this week. Starting tonight, I've got to call the hotline to see if my number's been called. So barring that, I will be back here next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Until then, keep rejoicing in the flow of creativity.